Hello, and welcome to the Psych and Business Podcast, where we highlight the integration of psychology and psychological principles into the world of business and organizations. I'm your host, Dr. Ernest Wade. I have another great guest for you today. Her name is Dr. Ginevra Drinka, and she is a coach and senior leader at Victoria's Secret & Company. Dr. Drinka has over a decade of consulting experience. She started consulting in the pharmaceutical industry in London and currently works at Victoria's Secret & Company, where she looks after enterprise-wide talent assessment strategy. Dr. Drinka also has a lot of side hustles, so this is going to be a very, very interesting conversation. Ginevra, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so excited to talk to you because you do so much, but I always want to start by asking, tell us about your journey, because you've got such a fascinating journey and have so many interests. Tell us about your experiences and how that led to where you are now.
Yeah. So the question is, how far back you want to go? to keep it focused, I will bring a little bit of the personal into it, which is my, my dad is a psychiatrist, and my late, incredible, wonderful mother was a psychoanalyst. And so the apple doesn't fall very far from the tree. I grew up, you know, like our dinner table conversations could be very lively and interesting. And so I think because of that, I've just always had this really deep interest in the mind, how the mind works, all these kind of unconscious processes that we bring into things. And, you know, then in the world of work, I realized quite early on that I didn't want to become a clinician. Just all of the gripes you can imagine about insurance companies and all of that. And so I really just became fascinated with how kind of like the best of psychology can be applied to businesses and human performance.
Yeah, that's such an interesting background. I mean, that's such a strong foundation to have the psychiatry and the psychoanalytics. And I love the way that you said how, you know, the best of psychology can be applied to business. That's what we want to talk about. And that's what we really love to talk about. So let's talk a little bit about some of the work that you do and some of your experiences. I know you currently work with Victoria's Secret & Company. Tell us about what you do there as much as you can.
Yeah, of course. So so I was brought in really to kind of shepherd and create and develop a new talent assessment strategy for the organization. And so some of the things, you know, probably not super surprisingly, some of the things that we're kind of looking to get into sooner rather than later are around succession planning, where we can use assessments in that process really to kind of help our leaders get them ready for what's to come and what's next, leadership development, like those types of things. But I'm very, very excited about the future with VS & Co.
Yeah, so this is really interesting because you talk a little bit about succession planning. Describe for our audience what that is and why that's important for an organization to engage in that.
Yeah, really great question. So so VS is the second organization that I've worked at internally where we do succession planning kind of processes. I've done some external consulting with that as well, but really it's, you know, there's a few different ways that you can take it. You have roles that you're deeming as critical to the success of the organization. And, you know, as we all saw with the pandemic, people can get sick, people can get burnt out and, you know, want to step away from the organization. There was a lot of, especially during the pandemic, a lot of executive turnover, like more so than other groups within organizations. So it really just kind of assessing your bench, getting really clear on, you know, what are the strengths, the developmental opportunities for the leaders that we have on the bench in a particular role. And then helping kind of, you know, shepherd them through that process. So, you know, maybe it's working with a coach to help them get really ready and clear on their development steps, you know, as they want to progress. Other times, other organizations that I've worked at and kind of more of like a selection element has been around, we have this slate of successors. Hey, psychologist, come in and assess and tell me which one you think is going to be best based on, you know, their traits and drivers and those types of things.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And you mentioned something I want to pull on a little bit. You talked about assessments and how you use that to help you in the selection process. Tell us a little bit about some of the assessments that you engage in and how you leverage those to help you either in succession planning or leadership selection.
Yeah. So this isn't like specific to VS and Co, kind of more broadly around like, because when I started out, it was more an external consulting. And So we would get kind of a range of assessments. We would use cognitive ability tests. Several years ago, I'm like blanking on the name of the assessment we used. It was the one that the NFL used to use, but now there's been some like problems around bias with it. So it's not used as much anymore. But using some sort of like cognitive ability test, you know, to get really clear on you know where this individual sits, and then personality assessments, motivation assessments, making sure that the person is really lined up in terms of you know they're going to be motivated and engaged in this role. So you know, Hogan is a typical one, kind of HPI, HDS, MVPI. Using those assessments is one that a lot of organizations use. What are some other assessments? I mean, the other thing too, though, is then, you know, getting really clear about the success profile for the role. So, you know, is having a conversation with the incumbent, having a conversation with folks on the C-suite, if it's, you know, a really critical high profile role, just to ensure, you know, what we're assessing against, is this person really going to meet the mark? When I was at YSC, which has recently in the past couple of years been acquired by Accenture, when I was at that organization, we used to do a very, very in-depth, you know, like kind of interview conversation with a trained psychologist. So one of the people who was mentoring me through the process was a clinical psychologist who had pivoted into organizational work. And he would do one thing that really stuck with me is he would interview around, you know, tell me about your family. And sometimes leaders would push back and be like, how is this relevant? Mm-hmm. And, you know, he made clear, he was like, your family is the first team you were ever on. And your dynamics in your family can tell me a lot about how you show up on a team and how you lead a team, how you can be a team player or not. So all of those types of things, really interesting.
I love that perspective, and it kind of fits into that psychodynamic approach of really trying to understand, you know, who you are and how that impacts the organization. And I love that thought of your family is the first team that you've been on. I'm so used to assessments from a coaching perspective, but it sounds like this is a really different approach when you're doing it for selection. How do you use the material from the assessment? You mentioned the Hogan and stuff. How do you use that to help in selection? Because from a coaching perspective, you work with that individual. How do you use that in the selection process?
Yeah, I'm definitely not as much of an expert on the selection end. Like you, I like and development all day. Like I'm kind of one of those people where, you know, I view everybody as developable to an extent, right? But I think in a selection case, like the way we would be using it is like, you know, we have with Hogan, for example, like certain benchmarks that we on certain, you know, traits and drivers that we want them to hit. You know, similar with like, you know, kind of what's motivating them. Same with the cognitive ability. I remember there being like, you know, if you're an executive, you need to be hitting 80th percentile on whatever. So using it in that kind of way. And then, you know, then from there, you have maybe a slate of like two or three potential successors, really just looking at all the trade-offs within the bunch of leaders that you have in front of you.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And that fits right into the next thing I want to talk about, which is your focus on the application of science and being really evidence-based in your work. And I know you did some research in your past with learning agility and team performance. Tell us about what you found there and why that's important.
Yeah. So my dissertation, which is crazy to me, I'm 6 years out from that. It feels like yesterday and also feels like it could have been 2 decades ago with the pandemic kind of, you know, messing up all of our engagement time. but what I was looking at was really kind of revisiting in a way Amy Edmondson's team effectiveness, team psychological mm-hmm. safety model, and really kind of slotting in this definition of learning agility and like how we were measuring learning agility, because she outlined things as like learning behaviors, and they were a little mm-hmm. bit more vague, you know, 20, 25 years ago. Now, as there's been a lot more research, we had this 7-factor model that we were using to kind of slot in there. But essentially, you know, not super surprising, leaders who have a, you know, much more growth mindset, less of a fixed mindset, leaders mm-hmm. who are able to engage in coaching behavior, mm-hmm. you know, and coaching behavior can be as simple as just asking open-ended questions in conversations and not jumping to conclusions. Leaders who do that were much more likely to create the psychologically safe relationship with a subordinate and then drive the subordinate's learning agility and ultimately their performance. So yeah, that's what we found.
That's really interesting. And you know, I've had some leaders where they feel like they need to know everything, right? And so they don't want to appear as if they need to be taught. And so how do you balance that? How do you help leaders balance that with the thought that I'm leading, I need to know everything, I need to be the expert in everything, versus creating that learning environment where you're open and flexible and agile to learning?
Oh my gosh, that's such a good question. And definitely something that I think about, like, if not daily, I think about it weekly. I think this kind of gets into a broader thing around, you know, when you're a clinician and working with a patient, they come to you because they know that they need some sort of help. In organizations, it's a lot more sticky. It's a lot more political. You know, that's not necessarily the case where someone is coming to you because they know they need some sort of support or some sort of, you know, talent advisory or whatever you want to call it. I think, you know, I've worked with a range of leaders. It's interesting because I definitely see the most success in the ones who are more likely to be humble, have some sense of vulnerability, mm-hmm, you know, and mm-hmm. kind of get into that space. I think it is harder for leaders, you know, when they're kind of, my dissertation advisor, Warner Burke, used to kind of refer to this element of our learning agility model as, you know, you can't be a defensive person if you want to be successful. And unfortunately, that's something, you know, we see in a lot of leaders today, and they've been able to rise to that level, but are they necessarily like meeting the demands of 21st century, incredibly change agile leadership?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's, you made such a great point there, in that things have changed, especially since COVID, and things are continuing to change, that leaders really need to be adaptable and they need to be agile and they need to help their organizations be agile and adaptable. You've worked in so many great companies. I know you've worked at Nike, obviously at Victoria's Secret. What have you noticed from a cultural perspective as to how things are changing at these large organizations?
It's a really good question. I want to be optimistic, but at the same time, I also say I just finished reading a book last weekend, Kara Swisher's Burn Book. It's a tech love story, and it's all mm-hmm. about, you know, in a lot of ways, it's kind of the history of the internet, but a lot of these longstanding relationships that she has cultivated over a couple of decades with tech leaders. And, you know, reading that, it gave me a lot of pause around, you know, I think there's this sort of, you know, entrepreneurial kind of profile of leader who is mm-hmm. maybe much more likely to be really change agile and fluid and can flex and can, you know, like be like sort of create conditions in which failure is okay, because failure is just, it's the part, you know, it's a critical part and element of learning. But then on the other hand, I've just sort of, a lot of what she was saying really kind of mirrored with my experience. It's like where when leaders get to a certain level, it's like they can't, that fear of failure becomes so much greater. And you know, that vulnerability, I think it's really, really hard to tap into, especially if you're a publicly traded company and, you know, you say something and shareholders hear it and it just amplifies across the ecosystem that you don't have your stuff together, you know? So, mm-hmm. So I do hope that things are changing. I do hope that, you know, this time since COVID, where, you know, vulnerability and empathy seemed like they really mattered, you know, at least in the kind of early days of the pandemic. But, mm-hmm. you know, that is something that gives me a little bit of pause.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is such a fraught time that leaders have to be very careful. And so I can completely appreciate that sense of anxiety and that fear that comes along with allowing mistakes to happen, because you're so heavily punished for almost any mistake these days. So, it's very hard for leaders, especially as you mentioned in those publicly traded companies. Yeah. I want to talk a little bit more about something that you mentioned in terms of technology and startups. I know that one of your side hustles is working with startups, and you work with one of the startups now, Genius Mesh, I think is what it's called, mm-hmm. and you work with some of the leaders there. What do you notice about leadership in startups versus leadership in larger organizations? Because you kind of run the gamut of both. So what are you noticing about the different kinds of leaders that are
totally different types of leaders? I mean, I, you know, like as a psychologist, I'll think about like sort of like the profile of an entrepreneur versus like the mm-hmm. profile of a kind of more mature leader who's leading a publicly traded company. And so totally different. Just the like founders of startups that I've worked with, entrepreneurs, it very much more along these lines of it's okay to fail, because failure is part of the, you know, innovation process. You know, but then I think there also can sometimes be in some ways like a lack of maturity. And I'm not speaking of like some of the startups that I'm working with currently, but can mm-hmm. be like a lack of maturity in terms of, you know, just sort of understanding about like emotional intelligence and like, well, if you say this and do this or are like volatile, you know, to get your point across, like that's not going to fly in a more mature organization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can definitely appreciate that blend of that immaturity, but also that open-mindedness to failure and things like that, and how you help a leader balance that. You know, as a psychologist, you know, we study human behavior. What are some of the behavioral elements that you like to focus on when you're working with leaders and startups?
I mean, definitely learning agility. Like I feel so blessed and privileged that I was able to work with Warner Burke on my dissertation, and really, you know, as a student of his, just really understanding this construct really deeply, that I really think is at, you know, if there's kind of like a silver bullet to understand mm-hmm. what makes a good leader or not, it's this. It's like, are they able to learn quickly in new situations? And so that's something that I really try to tap into with folks that I coach. You know, I'll use a couple of different assessments usually in the process to try to kind of isolate, you know, learning agility is really highly correlated with openness to new experience, that the, mm-hmm, the personality mm-hmm. trait. And there's, you know, an element of overlap around conscientiousness as well. Some element of overlap around extroversion, although kind of more like the social components of extroversion, less so like the drive components. Mm-hmm. And so when I have a leader go through an assessment, that's something that I'm kind of starting to look for. But then also, you know, helping them kind of understand, like, how can you create a learning plan? Even if this is something that's not super natural to you, how do you learn best? How do you feel comfortable learning? And really kind of latching on to that to help them then grow and, you know, and seek feedback. I mean, that's like the number one thing that, you know, how can you seek feedback without being defensive?
Yeah. And I think that's such an important thing, especially as a leader, because especially the higher you go in leadership, the more isolated you get, the harder it is to get that open and honest feedback. And so I really appreciate that you work with the leaders to help them engage in some self-awareness as to where they are in terms of their learning ability, and then give them the plan to help improve that. Am I hearing that correctly?
Yes, definitely.
Now, I know you've also done a lot of your other side hustle is that you have your own executive coaching practice, and you've done a lot of work internationally. So how does culture play into this? Do you see this learning agility as being important regardless of what culture you're in? And are there different cultures that are more attuned to that versus not?
Really good question. So a lot of my international work, I would say, was kind of coinciding with like right around the time I was doing my dissertation and after, like right after. And I think like one thing that I noticed, so for a long time, I worked at a consulting company called BTS, a fantastic organization. And one thing that I noticed was, you know, we would have our kind of template of like best practices for leadership in, you know, and then be working with folks overseas and finding that, you know, sometimes like our best practices, like we really, really have to use a coaching approach because, mm-hmm. you know, here's what we know is showing up in the literature that is pretty well validated cross-culturally. However, yeah. you know, if I'm telling somebody in a country where there's like high power distance, you know, where they're, it's not as collaborative and like a little bit more kind of, you know, tell me what to do mm-hmm. and telling them that they need to be like super open and collaborative and it's not always going to fly. So yeah. I think culturally, for me, yeah. yeah. And so just sort of learning like, okay, this is what I can tell you from my perspective that I know works based on the data, based on the literature, knowing that the data in the literature does skew a little bit more, you know, developed Western countries. Mm-hmm. But what do you think? How could we make this work in your culture? Like, how could we make this work in your organization? Mm-hmm. What nuggets of this do you think resonate and you can kind of carry forward? So that's really kind of the approach yeah. that I would take.
I love what you're saying there. I'm such a big proponent for standing. I say standing on the shoulders of others, you know, giants who've come before, and that's through research, right? People who have done research are the shoulders that we stand upon. And I love your approach of taking that data and you know, turning it into information that can then be siphoned and figured out how can we make this work for us in our environment, right? Not just taking it as it is, but understanding the context that's important as well and how that will relate in the specific context that you're in.
Yeah.
Ginevra, we could go on and on. We've covered so much information in just a short amount of time, but I want to be respectful of your time. How do people reach you if they want to follow the conversation, get your services? You know, what's a good way of contacting you?
Yeah. LinkedIn. It's funny. I'm not really on much social media these days, except for LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. I have a website. It's just www.ginevradrinka.com. But LinkedIn really is the best way to reach me. So, yeah.
So I always want to take advantage of the experts that we have on the show and ask, what's a tip that you can share with businesses, organizations, leaders, especially in this time that we're in?
Yeah. I really think that the most undervalued skill in leadership is active listening. Mm. So any kind of influence, you know, if you're working in an organization as a consultant in kind of a talent management space or organizational psychology space, any kind of influencing that you can do around that, I realize that's kind of hard, like telling someone to listen better. So I haven't really like landed the best way to do that, but that's something that really sticks with me. I think there's a tendency in a lot of organizations to sort of explain away expert data. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so really like really, you know, trusting the experts. Yeah.
Yeah. I love what you're saying and I completely agree. I actually have an individual episode where I talk about the importance of active listening for leaders. And I walk yeah. through some of the things that is best practices that the research has That's out there. So but important. I think, as you said, active listening is one of those things that gets bundled into communication and then people just talk, but they don't listen exactly. and they don't pay attention to what people are actually saying. So it is such a critical skill and behavior that I think leaders really need to improve upon. So completely agree with what you're saying. Ginevra, this has been so much fun again, having you on the show. This has been fantastic. We'll have to have you come back and talk a little more about some of the fantastic work that you're doing. But thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
Great. And to our listeners, thanks for listening. We hope you will join us again next time. Thank you.